All right, counsel, welcome to the Court of Appeals. In a moment, we are going to call your case. I will note that each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument with a 5-minute rebuttal. On the podium, there is a button to adjust the podium up or down, so please utilize that. In addition, this is being recorded, so when you start your argument, please identify yourself. That recording will be released on our website after the argument. With that, the appellate can begin when you are ready. And actually, at this time, we are going to call court file A240487, Natalie Storm Pettit, and on behalf of the minor child, respondent versus Jeremy Pettit, appellant. Counsel, you can begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, David Schoberg appearing on behalf of the appellant. Here today asking the court to reverse the district court's decision that granted an order for protection against Mr. Pettit. Your Honors, on October 22nd, 2023, there was an incident at the party's homestead. These parties were married, these parties had filed for divorce. Prior to October 22nd, there had been ongoing disputes regarding the Ms. Pettit's drug use. And this came to a head after, on September 3rd, 2023, she was found in a motor vehicle with two minor children under the influence of methamphetamines. On October 22nd, 2023, Mr. Pettit, again suspecting the respondent in this case of consuming narcotics, called the police. When the police arrived, Ms. Pettit then retreated to the bathtub, where she waited over an hour to avoid the police. She talked to numerous people on the telephone, including her attorney, CPS, and her mother. After the police left, she attempted to leave with the minor children again. Mr. Pettit called the police. And then approximately 4 hours later, after he called the police for the second time, the police arrived to try to sort out this civil dispute between these parties. Ms. Pettit had 10 to 15 minutes to discuss this matter with the police. She did not allege any wrongdoing on behalf of Mr. Pettit. She left, notably in a cab. Following this incident, hours later, she alleges domestic abuse occurred. Now, in this particular case, there's several allegations of domestic assault that occurred. And it's while it's true that Thompson and Shrimsher overturned the Cass cases and the related cases as far as it relates to present, the necessity to show present harm once domestic abuse has occurred, the district court is still tasked with examining all of the relevant factors, including timing, frequency, severity, and likelihood of further abuse.
So can I ask you, the argument that I thought you're making in your brief, and I'm glad we got to Thompson, is that the evidence was insufficient to support the factual findings of abuse. I mean, what you're talking about now is Thompson says, look at, like, is there abuse? You can look at the factual findings. If there is past abuse that's supported and there are factual findings of it supported by the record, then a district court, in exercising its discretion whether to enter an order, considers the factors that you're describing. I had understood, but maybe I misunderstood, your argument as being that there is absence of evidence to support the factual findings.
So I think there's two arguments here. Number one, it's the question of whether there was sufficient facts before the court to grant of domestic abuse to grant the order for protection. And there's a secondary issue of the timeliness argument that was raised.
Oh, okay. So if I just look at the first one and we look at the district court's order, in which it found that acts of domestic abuse have occurred, including the following. Petitioner provided credible testimony outlining incidents of domestic abuse, including slamming petitioner into a counter, slamming petitioner against a bed, slamming petitioner. Are you saying that there's not an evidentiary basis for those factual findings?
So, Your Honor, so we go to the credibility of the parties, which obviously the district court has the ability to make determinations with regards to credibility. So when you look through the testimony, there was testimony a brief testimony outlining previous incidents. However, I would like to point out some of those incidents.
But are you, the court found it was credible testimony from petitioner. Is there more for us to do? If the court found it credible, you recognize that the district court has pretty much its zone if someone is testifying to these things and the court finds it credible. Isn't that sufficient evidence right there to support it?
Not if the evidence is clearly erroneous, contrary to the weight of the evidence. And I think here we have a weight of the evidence issue. So specifically, we talk about the 2020 incidents. And it's a little bit unclear specifically when the court talks about the counter and there's a push against the counter and there's this other incident. It's a little bit ambiguous as specifically which incidents the court is referring to. It has to be parsed out a little bit. It's still a little bit ambiguous. I don't think that's a grounds to necessarily reverse it. But having said that, when we start looking through the allegations themselves, we go back to the 2020, prior to the parties being even married, and we have this history of the Ms. Pettit, in this case, abusing the order for protection process, and much like I would allege in this case, to accomplish other goals other than trying to protect herself or her minor children. So specifically in 2020, she was accused and found to have methamphetamines in her system while pregnant. After the minor child was born, it was a custody dispute. She's again asked if this minor child, if the dad was any risk for the minor child, and again she said no to the law enforcement. And within a few hours, she had filed an order for protection, changing her story to get temporary custody of that minor child to do an exchange, and then immediately or subsequently dismisses that order for protection. So when we have these underlying factors that relate and center around these 2020 allegations.
So counsel, those facts you just mentioned, which finding as outlined by Judge Smith are those going to, in essence, counter or dispute? Because it seems to me the court made findings again that there was the petitioner was slammed into a counter, the petitioner was slammed against the bed, and the petitioner was slammed against the car window. It seems to me that the dispute or the argument you're making is, in essence, a credibility argument, that being she's abused the OFP process in the past, therefore she must be abusing the OFP process currently. It seems to me, as it relates to finding that the findings were clearly erroneous and contrary to the evidence. Again, which fact is this evidence contrary to?
So to the extent that the court found that domestic assault occurred in the 2020 incidents, and again, it's ambiguous specifically to which incidents the court makes those findings.
And you indicated earlier that that ambiguity may not be enough for this court to, again, reverse an OFP, so that ambiguity is not enough, and we're not finding that it's contrary to any one of these facts. Again, where is this line of kind of reasoning? I'm just trying to understand how is this getting us to that these facts were clearly erroneous or contrary to the weight of the evidence?
Sure. So we kind of look on to the additional basis that the Ms. Pettit provided in this case, Your Honor. So she talks about, and quite frankly, the vast majority of her testimony and the video recordings and the arguments of counsel were that Mr. Pettit was like to yell at her a lot and call her lots of names, and lots of derogatory names. But these in and of themselves don't arise to domestic abuse. Are they obnoxious? Absolutely. Are they abusive? Perhaps. But they don't arise to the level of domestic abuse that's defined within the statute. And so when we have, and we go into the pushing arguments, so there were some assertions that Mr. Pettit on occasion pushed Ms. Pettit. And I'm not going to argue that pushing could never arrive to the level of domestic abuse, because clearly under certain circumstances it could. But using her own words, when was the last time, so page 46, when was the last time Mr. Pettit caused you any sort of physical harm or abused you physically? Besides pushing me around a year ago where he actually hurt me. On October 22nd, 2023, he was screaming, he was in my face, pushing me around. That's just where it starts. So her concerns continues to be, he's screaming, he's yelling at me, and this is my basis for obtaining the order for protection. And her basis, and this is where I think we get back into the relevant factors that the court failed to recognize.
But counsel, again, in the statement you just made, part of her testimony was that on October 22nd, he was in my face screaming and pushing me around. Doesn't that, if she testified to that and the court said she's credible, again, going back to Judge Smith's question, what is there for us to do? How do we reverse that finding that the court relied on her testimony, that she said he was yelling and pushing me around on the specific date, and then the court said she's credible, in essence, I believe that. How do we, again, find that that finding, in fact, is clearly erroneous, absent a ton of other evidence that perhaps demonstrated that either she was committing perjury or there were so many facts to the contrary that she was being pushed around on that date?
So pushing around, and specifically how she describes it and how her own counsel described it, was pushing out of the way when he needs to go somewhere. I mean, I'm quoting specifically her counsel's closing arguments in that case.
And the characterization of the pushing is what you're disputing.
Correct, because specifically she doesn't say, hey, he pushed me down, he hurt me, he put me in fear of physical harm. It was, and specifically her testimony contradicts that. It says, well, you know, he pushed me around, but he didn't hurt me. It was a long time ago when he actually did something to hurt me. And when you look at the purpose of the order for protection, and again, using her own words here, her testimony wasn't that I'm afraid of him, I'm afraid that he's going to hurt me. Her testimony was, when she specifically asked, why did you feel it was time to file the order for protection following the October 22nd incident? And her answer was, every time I came home, he was calling the cops and he was screaming at me and name-calling. I didn't know how else to make it stop until I moved out. She was followed up with another follow-up question. Are you worried what might happen if the court denies your request for an order for protection today? Yes, and then followed up, why? Because I know, like, the toxic text will start again, the name-calling will start again. Again, she doesn't assert that she's fearful of Mr. Pettit. What she wants to avoid is the accusations of being a crackhead, the vulgar language, the name-calling. So in her own words, her basis for obtaining this order for protection wasn't to protect herself from the threat or the risk of domestic assault. It was, he's calling me names, we're fighting over my drug use, and I don't like it.
And counsel,
this would be a good basis. Sorry.
Counsel, as it relates to an HRO, I think that argument would, I get your argument and I get what you're saying, but my question is, with an OFP, in order to get it, you either need to have, again, physical harm, bodily assault or injury, or the fear of it. So in this case, it seems to me that the court is saying, based on their findings, that there was actually physical assault, that she was hit, she was pushed, she was, and I just want to make sure that I have the language correct, but she was slammed into a counter, she was hit, she was pushed. And then the court also said, again, I find her credible. Doesn't that make her intent? Does it matter what her intent was as it relates to the OFP? That being, if she proves that, in fact, physical abuse occurred within the statutory framework of the OFP and the court found her credible, is that enough?
So I think again, you look to Thompson versus Shermshire, and you look at the relevant factors, time and frequency, severity, and likelihood of further abuse. You come into those type of analysis, which the court failed to do in this case. Failed court to consider any of those factors, the timeliness, why she brought it, the purpose of this, which was very transparent in this case, is I got a divorce and I'm doing drugs and I want to avoid this this confrontation. In an HRO, I think all of the name calling, the confrontation, All of that would have been super relevant and probably grounds to grant a harassment restraining order. But that type of behavior is not sufficient for an order for protection. And so then we start talking about a timing issue, which is allegations of domestic assault that date back prior to the parties even getting married, having a child, distant allegations that, again, the court glossed over, didn't address, just simply said, I find that she met her statutory burden, that there had occurred a domestic assault, gave some vague findings that there was a push, counter, some bruising, and left it at that, Your Honor. So based upon all this, Your Honor, I'm asking the court to overturn the district court's finding as clearly erroneous based upon the weight of the evidence and, frankly, Ms. Pettit's own words and her own testimony as far as the basis and her desired relief. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sean Ranke, and may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Natalie Pettit. We are asking the court this morning to affirm the decision of the district court. I want to start by addressing some of the questions that the court asked counsel. The question that Judge Smith asked was, if the court found it credible, the district court that is there anything more for us to do? And Your Honors, I submit that the answer to that is an unequivocal no. The Thompson case stands clear that where there is domestic abuse, as the district court found in this case, then an order for protection may issue.
Although I think, I'm looking at Thompson, and Thompson clearly has, you know, parts one and part two. Part one is, was there domestic abuse, which can be past physical harm? Court found that here, decided it was based on credible testimony, et cetera. But there is a part two. As you know, your opposing counsel said, which is it having now found domestic abuse, was it an abuse of discretion to issue the OFP? And in Thompson, the Supreme Court, you know, said, you know, we need to take into account, a district court needs to take into account a number of factors, and noted that the district court in that case concluded that although the domestic abuse was in the past, it was a course of conduct that has and continues to terrorize Thompson. The appellant in that case continued through means he's very aware of to control and disrupt life, et cetera. So there is a separate question. You find the domestic abuse. Now is an abuse of discretion to actually issue the order. Is this order sufficient for our review to decide whether that, yes, there's domestic abuse found, but should the order have issued?
Yes, there is, Your Honor, because the Thompson opinion requires that the district court make a decision, and that decision is within that court's discretion. Thompson discusses, as counsel mentioned, the timing, frequency, severity, likelihood of further abuse. This court has interpreted that language in Thompson, and I apologize this wasn't included in our brief. It wasn't a matter raised in the briefing. But I'm looking at the Frandrup opinion, 2022 Westlaw 219-5539. And this court held, and I'm quoting from the opinion, nothing in Thompson requires a district court to consider particular circumstances or make particular findings as the party advocates. Rather, Thompson affirms the district court's broad discretion to issue or not issue an OFP where it finds that the respondent committed acts of domestic abuse. So the district court has a broad discretion once that finding has been made. And when this court reviews issues of discretion, it looks to whether or not the district court abused that discretion. And an abuse of discretion occurs when this court is left with a firm and definite conviction that a finding or a result is outside the applicable law. That's the Kenny opinion, 963 Northwest 2nd, 214. Here, the district court heard testimony. The parties' opinions greatly differ on what occurred. They presented very different pictures of what happened. But the respondent in this case did admit to certain things. He did admit to the fact that although he disagreed on the incident of sexual abuse, there was an incident where he questioned her during a sexual encounter on what another man might prefer. Counsel raised the issue of how the respondent in this case, or the appellant, believed that my client was using drugs on October 22nd. That's not what the transcript says. If you look at transcript from December 19th at page 102, the appellant clearly states that he already decided well before my client came home that day that he was going to drug test her. He had already made up his mind on that. Absent any indicia of drug use, he decided he was going to push her on this issue. So the district court heard testimony over the course of 2 days of trial, heard from a guardian ad litem, heard from the client, saw evidence, and determined that domestic abuse did in fact occur. At that point, the question is, does the district court use its broad discretion to issue that order for protection? Broadly speaking, the court heard evidence from my client who said she was worried that every time the appellant got angry, she didn't know where it was going to go. Counsel talked about the texting, the messages, pushing, and things like that. But Ms. Pettit talked to the district court about how those things were a precursor to other abuse. Mr. Pettit harmed Ms. Pettit. That was a finding by the district court. The district court made those findings based on the evidence. This court, as you know, does not reconcile conflicting evidence. This court doesn't make credibility determinations. It reviews the record in a light most favorable to the findings of the district court and determines whether or not an abuse of discretion occurred. And is there a firm and definite conviction that domestic abuse did not happen here? It happened. It happened multiple times. The district court made findings about how domestic abuse happened on more than one occasion. It heard evidence of how Ms. Pettit was fearful, of how what was happening at the time of the divorce could escalate into something more. So the district court has broad discretion, and it utilized that broad discretion. Because 518B.01 requires, did abuse occur? Not when did the abuse occur, but did it occur? And here it did. Even if there was some sort of a temporal component, Ms. Pettit testified about how the things that were happening made her fearful of what was going to happen next. This incident on October 22nd, they are standing nose to nose while she's being shouted at by the appellant and wondering, he hit me a year ago and he hit me multiple times before that. Is he going to hit me today? The district court has broad discretion. It used that discretion in granting an order for protection. It made findings that this court does not reconsider unless there's a firm and definite conviction otherwise. And based on the totality of the testimony, we submit to you that these findings were proper. They were an appropriate use of the court's discretion and ability to make decisions and findings relative to the credibility of the parties, and that the granting of an order for protection was well within the district court's broad authority to do. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we are asking the court to affirm the order for protection in this case. And Your Honor, absent any further questions from the court, I will yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honor, just briefly in response. Opposing counsel here, opening remarks was, if there is a finding of domestic assault, unequivocally, the court may and should grant that without any reference to the additional factors that was outlined in Shrimsher, Thompson v. Shrimsher. This position, I find problematic from this perspective. You could have an act of domestic assault that's 10 years old, 20 years old. And based upon his arguments, So long as the finding of the court is that an act of domestic abuse occurred, the court would not need to consider any of those remaining factors and could then grant the order for protection. And I think that's a fallacy. I think these, while there might be...
I'm not 100% sure that's what he said. I thought it was more relevant to what we were doing here and what the issue raised on appeal.
Correct. But his argument was, unequivocally, if there's a finding of domestic assault, that was sufficient to grant it. And they subsequently argued that, pursuant to an unpublished opinion, that no consideration or no specific findings that the court needs to make with regards to those the second portion of the Thompson-Shrimsher matter. So I don't think it's enough just to say, hey, there is a finding and there is no other consideration that should occur. And that would be my argument, Your Honor. So unless the court has other further questions, the appellant rests.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And thank you both, counsel. With that, this case has been submitted and an opinion will issue within the statutory time frame. And thank you.